too many people want to make too big an incremental step. They want to go from zero to 100 in, you know, in 10 feet. And you can't go from zero to 100 in 10 feet. And so incremental is a big deal. And I've watched, I mean, the young people who've come here for our apprenticeship program and things, I've watched numerous of them, you know, kind of in a three-step process. And so what might those steps look like? So the first step would be,
Joel Salatine, how are you?
I'm doing great, Andy, and it's great to be with you.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. Let's start from the top here. As I mentioned off camera, you were quite the inspiration to me and my family over a decade ago, just getting on the health food and eating well part of our lives. And I just want to tell me about your story and what exactly you do at Polyface Farms.
Yeah, so we're our family came here when I was 4 years old in 1961. So if you're quick with math, you know that I'm right at 67. And we came here. Dad was an accountant, Mom was a school teacher, and Dad saw very early on, we always said Dad was organic before Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring. And His dad, my paternal grandfather, was a charter subscriber to Rodale's Organic Gardening and Farming magazine back in, 1945, something like that. So Dad grew up in that non-chemical composting, you know, kind of arrangement. And he saw early on just had a desire for, you know, self-reliance, self-sufficiency, independence from, you know, from the chemical cartels and the system. And so we came to this gully, worn out rock pile in about 1961. And he, of course, he was an accountant. He worked out. Mom was a school teacher. And the two off-farm jobs, you know, eventually paid the mortgage. Took about 10, 11 years to pay for it. And during that time, we were basically glorified homesteaders. It was not a business. We grew our own food. We had our firewood. In 1967, I was 10, and I got my first chickens, and I dipped my toe in this farm thing and just loved it. I mean, I just loved it. Not only as a almost a spiritual thing, but as a business that you know, hey man, I was selling eggs. I had customers. I was the man, you know. We got to call Joel. We need some eggs, you know. And as a kid, for you know, to have people who, whatever, you know, patronize you and say, hey, you know, we depend on you for breakfast. Man, that's a powerful thing for a, you know, for a youngster. And so I had these chickens, and I really, you know, got the farm bug. There were three of us kids. And I was the only one who really took an interest, a serious interest in the farm. So Dad was extremely creative. I'm at that stage in my life. I mean, he passed away in 1988, you know, it's been, more than 30 years, 35 years. And I realize the older I get, the smarter he was. And sometimes it takes a little while to realize that. But he totally got the non-chemical, started moving cows around. He was very much an inventor, invented some portable electric fence at that time so we could move the cows around. We started composting. We direct marketed. He did a portable infrastructure, developed a portable shade mobile for cows, portable chicken shelters for chickens. We just headed down this pathway. So, a long story short. So I came back to the farm full time, September 24, 1982, I had worked 2.5 years out as an investigative reporter for a local newspaper after college and was trying to, how do I get, you know, the farm was a great place to live, great food, great life. But it wasn't a business, you know, how do we make a living here? And So Teresa and I, when we got the attic of the old farmhouse here, lived up in the attic, we called it our penthouse. It's all how you look at it. And we drove a $50 car. We lived on $300 a month. If we didn't grow it, we didn't eat it. We didn't have a TV. We still don't have a TV. We never went out to eat. We never went on vacation. We just, you know, put ourselves to this. And within a couple of years, we had saved up enough. Andy, I think it's important for everybody to understand, we saved up enough by living so cheaply. We were able to save up enough in 2 years that we could live here for 1 year without an income.
Wow.
So that was our nest egg. So I handed in my 2 week notice, stepped out of that office. We came back home. Everybody thought it was the stupidest thing in the world. All of my friends, all of our acquaintances, what, you know, you're giving up a paycheck, you know, blah, blah, blah. And, but my thing was, by that time, I realized that I was very employable. You know, I was not afraid to wash dishes in the back of a restaurant. I didn't, you know, and I realized that if the farm didn't work out, I could find work anywhere because everybody's looking for somebody dependable, loyal, who can think and doesn't whine and complain, that sort of thing.
Yeah. And I tell it to my kids all the time, just have those qualities, to show up and be dependable and have a good attitude.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. The bar of dependability, loyalty, and, you know, giving 110%, is so low that you can get work anywhere. So anyway, came back to the farm. I fully expected that we wouldn't make it. I thought we would probably not, that I'd have to go back out off farm for a while. But as it turned out, that little $10,000 nest egg, because we were living so cheaply, it just stretched and stretched into 2 years and then into three. And we started direct marketing. We started the chickens. I sold firewood. I helped a guy build fence for a little bit of cash. I helped a guy plant some trees for a little bit of cash. You know, so we were just, what could we plug? You know, what could we plug the holes in? And by the end of the third year, we were able to sigh and say, whew, you know, we're going to make it. It took us 3 years, but by the third year, we had a little customer base. Things were moving along. And today, we have about 22 of us earn a living from the farm. We have about 10,000 customers. We ship nationwide. We have 1,000 head of cattle. We do, I don't know what, 800 hogs a year, 24,000 chickens. We do, I don't know, 120,000 dozen eggs. We have lamb, we have turkeys, rabbits, and we have a sawmill. So we sell lumber as well and continue selling firewood along some. And it's a, you know, it's a real going concern. I mean, it's a real deal.
Sure. So you've touched on so many different things, but I'd like to start with, let's say, somebody that's a smaller scale, if you would. So for example, I live in Atlanta, Georgia. We have a garden every year. During the summer times, we don't buy vegetables because we grow all of our own. But I live in suburbia. How does somebody, and this is really not for myself, but I have so many people inquiring. It's a thing now, urban farming. Yeah. How do you start and where would you start if you would? Where would you start in all that?
Yeah. Well, it's a proverbial, you know, what can you do now with what you have? And so many times people, I run into this all the time where people feel like they can't start because they don't have enough. And we live in a time of where we cultivate in our culture, we cultivate not enough. We go to bed, we say, I didn't get enough done. We get up in the morning, we said, I didn't get enough sleep. We say we don't have, you know, we live in this not enough. So the key here is, what can I do where I am with what I've got? And it can be as simple as a quart jar of mung bean sprouts on the windowsill. You know, those are highly nutritious, and that can be done anywhere. It can be as simple as a little, a little 12-inch by 12-inch vermicomposting kit under your kitchen sink to get earthworm castings to at least, feed your potted plants. There are all sorts of neat contraptions today, like these hanging PVC pipes with little pockets in them, and you pack compost in there. You hang it on your front porch, and you can have fresh herbs growing in these little pockets. Pots, pot gardens. That's a little bit of play on words there, pot gardens. But you can have these pots. You can have honeybees. You can have a beehive on your roof of your house. In my book, Polyface Micro, I talk about how to have chickens and rabbits in a Manhattan apartment. Using deep bedding, it doesn't take any more footprint than a Lazy Boy recliner. And you can have three chickens, and you can feed them all your kitchen scraps. They'll get eggs for you. And what you do is you make a top, and you make a bottom, and the bottom is full of carbon that the chickens can stir, basically make compost. And that eliminates odor, eliminates smell. And the chickens then are happy, and it doesn't take a bigger footprint than a Lazy Boy recliner. So there are a tremendous number of things. In fact, on my blog, about a month and a half ago, I had a blog reader from Austria who does CAD design, and he used some AI and CAD design to actually create a mock-up of what an apartment three chicken thing could look like, glass like a terrarium, and very, very clever. There are all sorts of things you can do in the city to start down this what I call a disentanglement path. That's what I'm hearing, Andy. People come up to me and they say, how do I disentangle? I don't want to be entangled to the system anymore. How do I disentangle? Right. And that's what we're talking about.
It really is. And also to give you some personal, I guess, anecdotal, you could just say just experience. My wife and I are one of the happiest times, and even my kids, the happiest times we have are together and then being outside. And then just this fulfillment of growing our own stuff. We know where it's come from. We put in the labor and the time. And we know it's just good food. It's good organic food. So again, just personal anecdotal experience. And yeah, it's just a joy. Let's talk about, if you don't mind, scaling this, because I have some friends that are scaling this or trying to scale it. And I know you do a lot of consultative work. First of all, what are you seeing, if you would, with people that want out of the disentanglement and then they're going outside the city into a more rural area? It doesn't have to be completely out of the city, if you would, but just more rural area, and they're buying up land.
Right.
What are you seeing? Like, what is their motivation for that? And what are they trying to accomplish? Are they just trying to get more land, or are they trying to make something sustainable? And what are the challenges that they're facing as well?
Yeah. So my latest book, the title is Homestead Tsunami, Good for Country Critters and Kids. And it's basically the why of this, you just described it, this what I call a homestead tsunami. There is a deep, intuitive, I think, understanding in the heart of people that if the wheels fall off, I don't want to be in a city. I want to be, where I can, shoot a deer, drink out of a spring, build a teepee. You can get as survivalist as you want to get. But the point is, if you're going to survive in a crisis situation, it's generally instinctually simpler in a rural setting than in an urban setting. Now. You obviously have a yard. You've got a house situation. So in that situation, for example, if you invested in a cistern, for example, a cistern to catch rainwater, so that you had a a couple thousand gallons of potable water off your roof. Well, then if the city water shuts down, you've still got water. You could have a solarium on the side of your house, and that solarium would grow vegetables in the wintertime and give you passive heat. So those are things in an urban setting you can do to kind of take the edge off of this, off of the fragility or the risk of, you know, I think that things happen because fraternities have a certain mindset and they head down a path, maybe not intentionally, but, there are outcomes of how you think. And so a nation, a culture, for example, like ours, that now looks to the federal government to solve everything and wants an agency for everything that we do and more market intervention and all this, is going to create a fragile system of economy and a dependency culture.
Yeah, got it. So
the new 401k is living proximate to people who know how to grow things, fix things, and build things.
Right.
That's the new 401k. And so what's driving this movement to the countryside, I think, is a general understanding or a lack of trust in these, you know, built environments, and people are looking more for something that gets them a little bit of removal from dependency on the grid, on the, you know, on somebody else's water systems, you know, on all these things.
What we found, or my wife and I guess our thought process is, let's say we had, I don't know, 1,000 acres out in the country somewhere. And the motivation is not so much survival for a crisis or a survivalist, even though that very well could be it. That's part of it. But that's not the primary motivation. The primary motivation is just like, it's a quality of life, if you would. So let's say, assume that nothing happens, that we just, things are muddling around and go on their way. Well, we still have a great life, right? But let's say something does, we're fully sustainable. So either way we win, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And in this book, Homestead Tsunami, I describe the why. And you know, we're having I don't want to go down too far a rabbit hole here, but Andy, we're having an adolescent crisis in this country, from fentanyl to teen suicide to, you talk to any school counselor today, our young people with TikTok and everything else. And again, I don't want to get too far afield here, but let me tell you, how does a young person, I'm just going to touch one point here. How does a young person develop self-esteem, self-worth, you know, affirmation as a person? How we do that is to be successful at accomplishing meaningful tasks, to successfully accomplish meaningful tasks. Each one of those four words is important. Successful, accomplishing meaningful tasks. Yeah. So what's happened, Andy, in our culture is that we have reduced the ability of our 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 year olds to actually successfully complete meaningful tasks. They're just on screen time. They're on video games. And so one of the things that this visceral participation in growing and building and fixing things is, you can sit back and say, hey, you know, I grew that tomato. I canned that applesauce. I cut up that chicken those very visceral functional elements of life, create self-worth. They create self-worth. And I think that this whole kind of migration or renewed interest in rural life is not just, yeah, I want to grow my own tomatoes, but there's this whole umbrella of societal and cultural elements wrapped up in it. And that's part of what's driving this as well.
Yeah, again, so very well said. Some anecdotal experience again is I'm originally from Alaska, and I have five kids and two boys, and we took a guy's trip, a father and son trip back up to Alaska. This was last August, and that was during caribou hunting season. And I knew some people up there and some family up there, and we took my boys and I, we went caribou hunting, and we got a caribou. It was the best experience on every single level, from just the adventure of it, from just being together of it, from the hardship of it, and then actually killing our own meat, and my freezer stocked with it, and then we processed it all together. So it was, again, just exactly what you said. It was just going back, getting simpler, but just being together and then having responsibility of just taking care and feeding ourselves. That's really, it was awesome. So,
yeah, absolutely. You know, responsibility and I would just say decision making, maybe we could call it discernment, is a muscle. It's a muscle like any of our physical muscles. And when we are with our children or give our children opportunities to exercise their discernment, you know, is the chicken waterer clean or not? Is the nest box clean or not? Do I water the tomato? Do I water the tomato today or not? Or does it need mulch? Or, you know, I mean, those kinds of visceral decisions exercise our discernment, and it's on a completely different level than whether or not you should push this button on Candy Crush,
right?
It's a totally different deal, and children understand that they realize when they're actually being needed and needful, and providing value to the family and value in their own lives. And they yearn for that. In spite of all the whining and all the, they actually want, you know, the most foundational, whatever, need of a human is to feel needed.
Yeah.
You know, that's why old people who have pets live longer than people who don't have pets. I got to get up to feed the cat, you know?
Right.
We all need to feel needed, but you know, the video game doesn't actually need you. I mean, it can sit there and it doesn't have any need. So there's something about participating in life, in things that can respond. Even a tomato plant can, and I'm stuck on tomato. Well, I love tomatoes, but a tomato plant can respond. It responds to us. The chicken responds to us. And so to be with something that responds, that has choice to say, I will affirm you. That's a profound thing.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about the business side again, things. Let's talk first about the wealth thing. And I know you have some wealthy clients. I'm just asking, like, okay, so I have $1 million or $10 million or whatever that number is. And then we'll talk about the person that doesn't have as many options. But let's talk about the wealthy. $10 million, and what do? Go buy a 1,000 acres somewhere out in the middle and, you know, put a farmhouse on it? What's the business template, if you wonder, the business plan?
Yeah. Well, probably the most common thing that I see, because I do a fair amount of consulting, and I have in the last couple of years been contacted by, I think now five billionaires, not millionaires, billionaires, who have asked I think the wheels are going to fall off. Can you help me, you know, get a safe place? And so I've started calling these, they don't call it that, but I call these agrarian bunkers. You know, that what they want is an agrarian bunker. Okay.
That's what they are, right?
Yeah, that's what they are. And once in a while, one of them will do okay. But most of the time, they don't appreciate the level of whatever understanding, experience, practical working out of getting this to go. And they're used to just throwing money at things and making it happen. And so, you know, so I end up going and they've already spent who knows how much money on fences, and the fences are all in the wrong place, for example. So for the wealthy, I will tell you this, that we have helped about five of these folks find land near us that we manage for them. So they have a bug out place. They don't live on it. They're still doing their thing, but they know that if the wheels fall off and they can get there, they can join our community. And meanwhile, we're managing their land and upgrading it and getting fences in and water lines and developing it as a resilient farm production unit. And that's a big deal. So
that's a great idea.
So if you're a wealthy person and you can hook up with someone and just, you know, look, if you're wealthy, you're probably used to delegating. All right.
Right.
And enjoy delegating. The biggest, those of us who do some of this, you know, we talk amongst ourselves, and our biggest frustration is going to a wealthy person and they won't listen. Somehow they think that their whatever mental acuity to have achieved what they've achieved financially is going to translate immediately into which tree to cut, where to build a road, where to put on a fence, where to put the corral. And the fact is they end up, you know, wasting a tremendous amount of money in the wrong places, and then they get frustrated because, well, I thought this thing was going to, you know, generate some income. Well, it's not all that easy. And right. So if you can hook up with somebody who has a track record, you're in good shape. And like I say, we now manage, I think, five places of people who live in the city. They have independent wealth, but they now have this bug out place. And it's a very synergistic thing, because we can then expand and grow more and scale as a farm. We take care of their taxes and fences and, you know, that sort of thing. And they can kind of learn, you know, from us. We can take them along, and they don't have to be dumping a bunch of money in the wrong place. I mean, we just had one. We shepherded a pond project. They wanted to build a pond. Well, so we arranged for the excavator. We went over and we set it up and all this. And we've built whatever 20 ponds over time, and we're really good at siting and deciding how big, where it should be, that sort of thing. Pond. If you're not familiar with that, you know, you're gonna pour, you know, $20,000 in a pond, and it's gonna be in the wrong place. You're not going to have a clue, you know, how to do it. And so, we can leverage, you know, their investment. They can leverage our experience, and it's a very symbiotic thing. Running out as a farm novice with a pile of money in your pocket is one of the quickest ways to make a lot of bad decisions and lose a lot of money quickly.
Yeah, I think that is the template, knowing a lot of very wealthy people. They're very good at making money in what they've done, if you would. Yes. And they're very good at hiring managers to make decisions for them. And then they enjoy, as they should, they enjoy whatever they've invested in. So yeah. I think that is a great template. Now, let's talk about somebody that doesn't have a whole lot of options. Maybe they could either be single, or let's talk about that, somebody that's single, or let's say they have a young family, or even like doesn't even have to be a young family, but they don't have the options, but they want to do something, or they think they want to do mm-hmm. something like this. What would you recommend to them?
Yeah. So there's a lot of different things. I'm a big believer in the proximity principle. The proximity principle is whatever you want to do, get as close as you can to what you really want. If you can't do what you really want to do, get as close as you can to it. And what you really want to do will eventually come your way. Too many people want to make too big an incremental step. They want to go right. from zero. They want to go from zero to 100 in 10 feet. And you can't go from zero to 100 in 10 feet. And so incremental is a big deal. And I've watched, the young people who have come here for our apprenticeship program and things, I've watched numerous of them, kind of in a three-step process. And so what might those steps look like? So the first step would be to move near where you want to be. And that could be determined by politics, weather, landscape, memory. Our family went through here, and I just love that part of the country. Whatever it is, okay. But get to where you want to be, and rent. You don't have to buy anything. Rent, and let time be your friend. Don't be in a hurry. The worst financial decisions we make are when we're in hurry up mode. We don't buy the right car. We don't buy the right house. We don't buy the right piece of land. When you're in panic mode, I've got to buy this right now. You're not going to buy the right pants or the right shirt. When you're in a panic mode, rent for a while, get familiar with the community. If something comes up, you can buy it. Otherwise, sometimes you can collaborate with somebody. For example, that's one of the reasons I love pastured poultry. Numerous people have started with pastured poultry on an existing farm, and they don't spend a penny. In other words, they go to a beef cattle farm or an orchard or something. Hey, I'll run chickens on here and grow more grass for you, and you don't have to pay me a dime for it because the grass will grow better behind the chickens. And so they actually start a farm business on land that they don't pay any rent for and don't have to own. So the portable infrastructure is a big deal. Somebody's got an edge woodlot, you can start running some pigs in there with electric fencing. And so there are a lot of options. And in my book, John, I've written a bunch of books, and I'm big on not buying initially, but just starting. Find a friend, find a collaborator. It might be somebody at church. It might be somebody at the Raritan Club or a philanthropic organization or whatever. Circulate within the community and find those opportunities. There are the average American farmer is 60 years old. They are desperate. They are desperate for a pair of hands. Befriend one. He doesn't have to be organic. It doesn't matter. He still would love a pair of hands to help hold a board if he's nailing the other end. Just go and, shut down your Netflix and shut down your Caribbean cruise and go enjoy starting a friendship with a farm, and you would be surprised. Listen, I have letters from 80-year-old farmers saying, can you find me? I just got one last week. Can you find me a young person to inherit my farm to? My kids don't want it. They'll just sell it. Can you find me a young person to inherit my farm to? So there are opportunities, but you have to be willing to cultivate, to serve. You have to be willing to serve for a while to create emotional and friendship relational equity, so that you can then you'd be surprised what might come your way.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Somebody wants to give you a farm if you work it. That's a great deal. I couldn't think of a better investment or a better deal right now, to be candid with you.
Yeah.
I listened recently. This was fascinating to me. one of the barriers, if you would, for organic or purchasing organic is the cost of entry, if you would. And I listened to you, I don't remember where it was, but it was on an interview you had where you are actually very competitive now with the big players and cost.
Yeah.
So that's part of the business aspect of this. If you're, that shouldn't be a barrier of entry if you want to farm. And it certainly shouldn't be a barrier entry if you want to buy good food. If you would talk a little bit about that, how you're now, again, how organic is actually or is becoming very, very reasonable in price. And it's also very, there's a lot of, there's good money. You're a thriving farm. Good for organic and you're competing.
I don't have anything to hide. We're flat. 2023 was financially the best year we've ever had here in half a century.
Congratulations. That's music to my ears.
Yeah, never had such a good year. And it's a confluence of a lot of things, Andy, and thank you for pursuing this point because most of my life I've been accused of being a food elitist. You know, you've got to be a doctor, an attorney in order to, buy your food, that sort of thing, because the price has always been, higher than it is in the grocery store because we don't take government subsidies and all of our prices are figured in.
Let me interrupt you very real quick. So yes, but what we found, and I want to get to your point, but what we found as a family, we were paying more money, but we weren't meaning per item for good food, but we weren't spending as much because that was more filling and we weren't getting like the snacks, the chips and that sort of thing. And then we were saving significantly a lot more on doctor bills.
Yeah.
Just so you know.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. You're already out there. I mean, the quickest way and easiest way to save money is to buy unprocessed. Get a whole chicken, not a chicken breast. Get a quarter of beef, not, a T-bone steak. All of these, I mean, on our farm, we have substantial, price discounts for volume purchases because it's easier for everybody, right? And so, buy unprocessed and especially if you can go straight to the farmer. Well, what happened during COVID was that, and then the Ukraine thing that spiked fertilizer prices, the combination, that was a double whammy. The COVID thing, which disrupted our supply chain, and then Ukraine, which disrupted the whole fertilizer, other things. What happened was prices spiked, as you know. They spiked or you couldn't even get stuff. And what we found was that our prices were lower than Costco. Now they've adjusted now. That's no longer the case now, but they never came down that much. And the beauty was we didn't have to go up much because we didn't have a long supply chain. We didn't have that problem. We didn't have a warehouse where workers were getting sick, and we didn't have, we're not dependent on Vladimir Putin for our fertilizer. We don't buy any of it. So all of those things that were literally, black swan events within the greater system, we were immune to. And wow, I mean, for us, it was a real epiphany of if we can, as a farm business, if we can immunize ourselves, against the fragility of the system, that's a really, really big deal. And so interestingly, I'll just finish with this little tidbit. Spring a year ago, we finally figured out how to actually ship eggs. I never thought I would ship. What do you ship eggs? That's crazy, But we had people asking for them, and so okay, we can ship eggs. So we started shipping eggs last spring, and you know what? We can ship eggs to New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles cheaper than they can buy them at farmers market.
So awesome.
Metropolitan areas with their defund the police, their homelessness, their tax situations, their regulatory situations, they are so anti-business, in a lot of those areas that their cost of doing business and hiring somebody, I mean, California just raised the minimum wage of fast food workers, you know, to $20 an hour, okay? What that does is it makes all of us non-Californians very competitive. We can now, in other words, if a farmer like us in California wants to hire somebody to put away eggs, they're going to have to pay them $20 an hour. Well, we've got people here who think they've died and gone to heaven if they get 14, okay, or 15. And so because our cost of living is so much lower, our taxes are so much lower, our regulatory climate is so much lower. And so it's just an amazing inversion of these small government, laid back kind of old fashioned areas are able to sell into these metropolitan, expensive areas and actually compete at price just because the price of security and labor and everything else is so much higher in those areas.
And regulation. And one last question. So a friend of mine texted me just right before I got on. He wanted me to ask you a question. What is, so he has, I'm assuming, he has a few hundred acres, if not more, out in rural Georgia. And what's the net, or what's the gross he can make per acre having a small independent farm? And my guess is his acreage is less than 200. So yeah, what's the number or dollar per acre, if you would?
Okay.
You can see is reasonable.
Let me just give you our, what we do.
Yes, so, you would.
So we run 600 broilers per acre, and they're $20 a piece, so that's $12,000 per an acre. And then you've got the cows, the cattle, which are going to be about 800 per acre. Then you've got turkeys that are going to be about 10,000 per acre. And then you've got the Millennium Feathernet eggs that are going to be about 8,000 per acre. So if you add that up, what you've got is 0, 0, 8, 22. You've got $30,000 per acre. Now that's gross. Okay. But if you figure a 30% enterprise margin, that still gives you up there around $9,000 per acre to go to your overheads, you know, your property taxes and insurance and pay for your pickup truck and things like that. So that's where you get this permaculture stacking, where you get it's not just raising, you know, apples in an apple orchard or cattle or whatever. It's actually, you're stacking these enterprises on there, and then you're direct marketing them. So then you're getting retail dollar, not wholesale, which is only 9% of the retail dollar. You're getting the whole thing, and you start wearing the hats of the middlemen, you know, the distributor, the processor, the marketer. And that, you know, every farmer sits on leans on the corner of his pickup truck and whines to his neighbor, "Oh, there ain't no money because the middleman takes it all," right? And so for me, if the middleman is where the money is, then I want to be one, you know,
middleman, right?
Sign me up to be the middleman. And so that's exactly what we do. It's a pretty exciting time.
Sounds awesome. Well, Joel, I think this is a great place to wrap up. We could talk for hours and hours. I find it fascinating. I'm actually involved on the consumer level, mm-hmm. as well as doing it ourselves in our backyard. If you would, could you please give your contact info in three different ways? Number one, for the consumer out there that wants to buy your eggs or your chicken. Number two, if it's somebody that's looking for an apprenticeship, where they can reach out to you. And number third is that wealthy individual that, hey, I want to slab a land and a bug out farm, if you would, but I don't want to manage it and have you manage it. How would they go about doing that?
Sure. They're all roughly the same. We have one big comprehensive website, polyfacefarms.com, and it has different tabs for all these things. Polyfacefarms.com. Yeah, you can buy our beef, chicken, turkey, pork, whatever, eggs. And we welcome you to do that. And I'll tell you, Andy, nothing makes us happier than getting a note from somebody. Hey, I've been buying from you for a year. I finally found my local supplier or found my little 2-acre homestead spot, and I won't be buying as much, but I'm so thankful that you got me started. We are glad to be a pump primer for people who don't know where to turn and are looking for some place to start. Glad to do that. So polyfacefarms.com. Apprenticeship, same thing. Apprenticeship, we take queries from August 1 to August 10. And again, we open up a special little email spot on polyfacefarms.com for the apprenticeship. The person who's bought a place and wants us to come and take a look at it, same thing. Polyface Farms and Wendy, my personal assistant, picks up all those emails. And she fires the ones that I need to me and the ones that Daniel needs to him and the ones that are about money to Teresa, who handles the accounting. And so she disseminates those throughout. So the comprehensive website is Polyface Farms, P-O-L-Y-F-A-C-E, the farm of many faces. And I'm just one of the faces. There's a lot of faces. Polyface Farm, and we will absolutely be glad to serve anyone that contacts us.
Jewel, thank you so much. And you primed the pump for me about 15 years ago. And my family and I are very, very grateful to you. So thank you.
Thank you, Andy. It's been a delight to be with you.
Absolutely.